Okay, so maybe we can start again. So as I said this morning, one of the pet projects of Phil Anderson was what is the theory of the immune system? And so I'm very glad that we have you here to speak about this.
So I'm very glad I'm talking about this and not about social interactions. I took the request to be general and open to... Oh yeah, you can move from here? Okay. We'll see how well that goes. I took this request a bit too seriously, maybe, so there will be some technical stuff, but there'll be a lot of non-technical stuff. And I'll talk about the immune system. This is work we've been doing with Thierry Marat, who's also at DNS, over a couple of years now, with a lot of collaborators, both theoretical and experimental. And you may think that this is the most interesting building in this area, but right next door, there's the police station of the 5th arrondissement, which is well known to house one of the most famous imaginary detectives of French literature, Adamsberg. So I'll start with a whodunit. Think back to all the meetings you went to in remote locations, everybody's excited, there's an amazing party, and the next day, Joe is found dead. And next to Joe's body, there are a few drops of blood that don't belong to Joe. So this being scientists, they cry genetic tests for everyone, and genetic tests reveal that the murderer is one of two twins, either Alex or Terry. So genetic tests are based on DNA. Identical twins have exactly the same DNA, so they cannot distinguish and find the murderer between two identical twins. Everybody agrees?
No.
No. Who said no? But you know the story.
I know other things.
Okay, I mean, yes, I agree that let's say they do basic DNA testing, okay? We're not talking about your friend Steve Quake here. All right, so apart from that comment, does everybody agree?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I see this will go well. All right, so we bring in Detective Asia Behr to look at some more modern technologies. And so what Asia will look at is the immune system. So, of course, after the last 2 years, you're all experts in the immune system, right? Everybody knows everything about the immune system. You have T cells that recognize pathogens. So basically, they bind different molecules and they have this discrimination power to figure out whether this molecule is natural to your body and should be there, or whether it's a pathogen or foreign molecule, and then you should get rid of it and trigger an immune response. So if you trigger an immune response, what happens is the cell that recognizes the pathogen proliferates. It makes many copies of itself, and then we have this clone of these cells that's able to find the pathogen molecules more quickly and get rid of the infection from the organism. So each type of these molecules has one type of receptor. So to protect us against many different pathogens, we need many types of receptors. That means many different types of T cells. That's what we call a repertoire. And thanks to technology, relatively recently developed, you can go in, get a blood test, they'll sort out your T cells, sequence them, and you'll basically get a list of all the sequences, that the diverse sequences that make up your repertoire and protects you against pathogens. And since, so you get this list, and if cells appear many times, that receptor, so that sequence will appear many times. And when do they appear many times? Well, one reason is because they proliferated. And so, in a way, this list is actually a personalized medical record. So you go in, you get this blood test, and then you try and tell the doctor, no, I didn't have chicken pox when I was 6, and they'll tell you, well, no, you're lying. You did, because I can see it, okay? That's the general idea, and that's why people are interested in this. There's only one small problem. We don't yet really know how to read this medical record, right? We know it's there, but, you know, we're not there yet. But that's what we're interested in, and that's what a lot of other people are interested in. That's the name of the game. Okay, so how is this list of different T cells going to help us find the murderer? So what we're going to do is we're going to take a blood sample from our suspects and a blood sample that was found by Joe, and we're going to look at the number of shared sequences between the two samples. And just by looking at the number of shared sequences between two samples, we're able to figure out whether the two samples come from the same person or whether they come from two different people. This is what the data looks like. So this is the number of shared sequences if the sample comes from the same person, and the number of shared sequences if the data comes from two different people, in orange, and in pink if it comes from two identical twins. So two identical twins look essentially like any other two people. If you take you and me, we're not identical twins as far as I know, and you take you and your identical twin, will be here. But if you take you and you, you'll be here. Okay? There's a gap here. There's an order of magnitude difference. So basically, by counting the number of shared sequences, we're able to figure out who the murderer is. So of course, the murderer is Alex, because who else could it be in this talk? And I can ask that this is a signal that's stable over time. So if we do this a year later, or even 10 years later, or 20 years later, we'll still be able to figure out who the murderer is. Okay, but this being scientists, they want to know how it works. So how does it work? So a little bit more information about the immune repertoire. So I said it's a diverse ensemble of different T cells. We have of the order of 10 to the 12 T cells total, but 10 to the 9 different ones. So if you just unique them, you look at different ones, 10 to the 9 receptors. Okay, receptors are proteins. Proteins are made from genes, right? Everybody knows that? Remembers that? Good. So proteins are made from genes. So that means if you want to make 10 to the 9 different proteins, you need 10 to the 9 genes. But in fact, you have of the order of 10 to the 4 different genes in your body as humans. So that means 5 orders of magnitude more genes. So that means that it actually won't fit. So we have 10 to the 4 total. They fit in part of a cell that's called the nucleus. It's about 1 pixel in size. So if we were to fit 10 to the 5 more genes in here, that means our nucleus, instead of being a tenth of a pixel, would have to be 2 millimeters. So that's the size of a crayon. And that means our body would have to be 20 meters, which is 4 giraffes. Okay? So basic point, it won't fit. So nature has come up with a really funky way that combines combinatorics and randomness to generate diversity. Okay, a little bit of biology, it won't hurt, and this will lead us to the physics. So each of these immune receptors is made out of 3 parts, they're called V, D, and J, and in our genome we have templates for each of these parts, some number of templates for V, D, and J. And then the DNA gets edited. You actually cut your DNA, you pick one V, one D, one J in each cell, and you put them together. And you do this differently in different cells, which, given these numbers, gets us to about 1,000 different combinations. But we need to get to 10 to the 9th. So what happens next is there's the special molecules that come in and randomly insert and delete nucleotides at the junctions between the V and the D and the D and the J. And that gets us to 10 to the 9th, only because you're putting random letters in and out, that means that you can generate rubbish. And you do. In about 14% of the times, you'll generate things that will never be a protein, will never fold, will never be functional receptors. But they did undergo this process, and by looking at them, sequencing them, looking at the data, we can figure out what's the probability of generating a given receptor. We can learn the statistics of this process. So just to... So how do we do that? So we take a sequence, and we want to figure out from the sequence how it was made, what V, what D, and what J made it. But as you can easily realize by looking at the word example, so say I have two words, biological and physics. because I can put anything in and take anything out in the middle of it, I can go from biological physics to biotic aesthetics, biopic logistics, or biology basics, and so on and so on and so on. You get the idea, right? I can basically generate anything I want. So if I get biology basics, I don't know what the original words biological physics were. And it's the same at the DNA level. The gray line here and here is exactly the same. And I'm showing I can take two different V genes, two different D genes, and generate the same thing. Just because I can put anything in and take anything out. Okay? So what that means is we can't figure out in a deterministic way how this each sequence was made, but we have to do it in a probabilistic way. So we take each sequence and we build a library of all possible scenarios, by which I mean choice of V gene, D gene, and J gene, and number of insertions and deletions that is consistent with the observed real sequence. We assign weights to these scenarios, and we take all sequences and all scenarios to calculate observables, like marginal probabilities of using a given gene, having a certain number of deletions, insertions, and so on. And then we have a model, the most general factorizable model that is in agreement with known biology, that we use to recalculate these weights. And we do this self-consistently. Until it converges. And it does. It's bound to converge. There's reasons for this. You probably don't care. At the end of the day, we have these weights. We sum over the weights and the possible scenarios to calculate the probability of generating a given sequence. And that gives us the probability of generating each sequence. So now we could play a game. You could take our piece of paper and write any combination of A, T, C, and G on that piece of paper. And I could tell you what is the probability that that sequence of letters actually produced an immune receptor in your body. So we could play that, or you could go to a website and play it yourself. Or you could listen. So let's go with option three. So now we have the probability of generating any sequence. And we can take the sequences in our data sample and ask how many receptors do we have that have a probability to be generated that's 10 to the minus 10. We put a dot here, 10 to the minus 12, dot here, and so on. We make a density of this probability distribution, right, for our data set. This is what it looks like. It spans 20 orders of magnitude. It means you have receptors that are relatively likely to be generated and receptors that are much less likely to be generated. And what is likely being compared to? Well, it's being compared to 10 to the 9th, which is the number of unique receptors that you have, or 10 to the 12th, total number of receptors. Right? And we'll get back to that. But generally, 10 to the minus 5, although it's a small number, it's still relatively likely compared to how many will be generating. Now, the other interesting thing about this is this red spread. So that's the variance over of the order of 1,000 people. Okay, real people, like you and me. And it's very small. So what that tells us is that we're all the same. There's nothing special about us. No matter where we come from, what we eat, what we do, at the level of unique receptors, our probability of generation is governed by this biochemistry. It's a random process, but it's completely... what's the word I'm looking for? Tractable. We can control it. Okay, so it's a very universal process. And now that we have it, we can start asking questions. So for example, we can ask how many receptors do you and I share, or how many receptors do you and 1,000 other people share? So this is the number of individuals, like 2, 10, 100 sharing the same receptor. Data in blue, model in red. And you can see that basically the number of receptors you share with any number of people is completely predicted by chance.
This is now productive receptors, right?
I'm cheating. This is now productive receptors, and we can... It's productive receptors, but we also put a selection factor on top of it, that we learn a selection factor, but it's at the level of unique productive receptors. Okay. And the other question we can ask is basically whether humanity's fine. This is maybe a theme that will also come up in many different talks today. And so if we take all the 10 billion people that are alive on the planet today, we can ask, have we produced every possible receptor that there is to be produced? So the black line tells us no. The curve, this is basically the number of different receptors. Every time we sequence somebody new, well, every time we build, this is the model. We add a new person, we add data for the new receptors, and it's not saturating. So this is actually, of course, when we do the experiments, well, I don't do the experiments, when people do the experiments, they're not complete vampires. They don't suck out all the blood from people. So there's a sampling difference. This is the extrapolation of what's actually been sampled. Okay, but this is the model prediction because we can go further with the model. But anyway, the good news is that humanity's fine, right? At least in this respect, we're nowhere near saturation. But thanks to this fact that we keep on adding new people, we can identify still a person out of the whole worldwide population, not just the size of a conference. So what we have here is we have a completely stochastic process. Each one of us inside us has a random receptor generator. The rules and parameters of this random receptor generator are universal. They're the same for all of us. However, the realizations are different because the realizations of a random process. So think of yourself as continuously rolling die, and what you come up with is different than what I come up with. And thanks to that, we can identify you, but we can also predict what we'll share. Because we'll share the ones that are common, that are from the 10 to the minus 5 part of the distribution, and thanks to the ones from the 10 to the minus 25 part of the distribution, we can find you if you kill someone. So I guess that's the main message of my talk, but we can go on. And well, since we sequenced these people, we also found out that Pat and Terry had COVID. So how do you know that they had COVID without sequencing the virus? And well, this we know thanks to work we did early on in the first wave of the pandemic, where Pat and Terry went to another conference, this time in a skiing resort, and they came back home and they had COVID, so they self-isolated, and then blood was collected from them at day 15 up to 85 after the onset of symptoms. So they didn't get serious symptoms. They, you know, one of them lost smell, they had fever, but you know, they were not hospitalized, nothing bad happened to them. And there's this other point to add, we also have data from Pat and Terry from before the pandemic. So we'll get back to that. Anyway, we look at now the abundance of different T cells. So we look at frequencies of different T cells. This is what the data looks like, okay? It looks like a mess. You can't see anything. What you want is you want a peak somewhere. You want some T cells that fight the infection, okay? It's a mess. So what we did first, we did PCA on trajectories and we identified three clusters. Then nothing happened, purple cluster, T cells that didn't take part in the response, most of them. The cluster we expected, the green one with a peak at day 15, and then a late peak at around day 37, which we still don't understand, but other people have seen since. Okay, but we're physicists, so basically this data made us very uncomfortable to be concluding anything from it. So what we did is we decided to calibrate the noise model. So you see these two X's everywhere here? That means we had replicates. We had data from the same person, so Terry, day 15 at all days. So we plotted this data. This is what it looks like. So this means basically that Terry on day 15 had some T cells that in one sample taken at the same time were there in copy number 1, and in the other sample were in copy number 100. So you see there's a huge spread. Basically, this is the immunological definition of a diagonal, okay? It's very noisy. And it's noisy for a number of reasons, part of them being real and biological and not due to experimental noise. So if we want to go from the reads, which is the data we have, to the underlying distribution of frequencies, which is a power law, which we know from other reasons, and I'll later show you, but just trust me for now, we need to go through a number of steps. One is sampling. Again, not complete vampires. We don't pull out all of the blood. So that's, we say it's Poisson. And the other thing is this biological noise. What we're doing here is we're sequencing mRNA. mRNA is known to be produced in bursts, in an intermittent process. Nothing happens, bam. And so we model that by a long-tail distribution and negative binomial. We put this thing into the noise model, and that's how we translate this initial frequency, Paolo frequency, into reads. And we calibrate the elements of this model on the same day data. And then we use it as a basis for probabilistic inference of the response. So the response, we say, is just exponential response, only that not all cells expand, because we know that. Some don't expand, some do expand. And then we look at the posterior distribution to identify the ones that expand. And we get back the two trends, the peak at day 15, now with the points at year minus 1 and 2 added, so that you really see it's an expansion from something less, and a secondary peak later on. So we do get back these large expansions. Okay, so anyway, part of it is that we do see, so there's also different kinds of T cells. Once a T cell has encountered an infection, it gets a special flag that it's a memory T cell. And then when the infection comes back, it's faster to respond. So memory T cells are what gives you immunity. Well, T cells and B cells. It gives you immunity. When you get vaccinated, that's what you're trying to stimulate, these cells that will respond faster. So it turns out that after the infection, people had immunity. They had stable T cell immunity. But more interestingly, our two characters had memory T cells that we called as responding against SARS-CoV-2 a year and 2 years before COVID ever hit the planet, okay, or at least was identified. So they had pre-existing immunity. We'll get back to that. So now Daniel will say, well, but how do you know this has anything to do with COVID? Right, Daniel? Yeah. So this is a slide for Daniel. Okay, because most of you probably are not that into it. So at the same time, Pat, at day 20 after the onset of infections, Pat took part in a molecular fishing experiment where basically they took some SARS-CoV-2 proteins on molecular fishing rods and stuck it into Pat's blood. And then they pulled out all the receptors that bound to this specific SARS-CoV-2 protein. So it's only done for one protein, but, you know, so we pull them out and this is what comes out. We recover this trend, which is exactly the trend we saw before. And the ones in green here are the ones that we identified from our computational experiments. Okay, so we're basically getting all the high frequency and generally most of the responding T cells to this specific protein. So that gives us confidence we're actually getting COVID response. And there'll be more evidence. Okay, so then we had this only for one SARS-CoV-2 protein, so we wanted to do it for more. So we turned to large-scale fishing, same kind of experiment. You stick a bunch, this is public data from Adaptive. You stick a bunch of SARS-CoV-2 proteins on molecular fishing rods, put it in different people's blood who had COVID, pull out the T cells, and that those are the green ones we found. And the good news is that now we also know what COVID proteins they correspond to. So we take their data, we mix it with our responding T cells, and we build similarity networks. We find clusters that are now associated to SARS-CoV-2 proteins. I won't bore you with the details, but there's this pink one here, which is it's Pat's favorite SARS-CoV-2 protein. Basically, 21% of their response is geared against this one specific protein. And why am I telling you about this? Well, so it turns out that these T cells that recognize this thing were already there a year before COVID. And if you make a one amino acid mutation in it, you get back the common cold coronavirus. So what we're speculating here is that Pat had the cold before, and thanks to that, they had a mild infection later, potentially, right? Anyway, they had pre-existing immunity specifically against this thing. So how are we going to make money out of this, right? So basically now we turn to Terry and just to give everybody a chance. And we asked, well, so just by looking at people's T cells, can we figure out who had COVID and who didn't have COVID? Just by, you know, as I said before. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take the T cells that we know are, now we speculate, or have high confidence that are responding against COVID and Terry, and see whether, if we look at a data set of other people who had COVID and a control data set from 2017 of people who certainly didn't have COVID, and we look how frequent that T cell motif is, can we figure out who had COVID? So that's the true positives, and who didn't have COVID. So who has the receptor, but who didn't have COVID. And the answer is no, right? That this is a pretty bad ROC curve. Everybody agrees, right? It's pretty crap. Okay, so I won't bore you with the details, but when actually T cells recognize a protein, they recognize just a peptide on a scaffold. And this scaffold is pretty important. It's called HLA. We didn't have information about HLA in this COVID cohort. The HLA is the thing that you need to get right when you get a transplant, right? So it's very heterogeneous in the population, and it's important for this presentation process. Anyway, we could computationally infer it, and we did. And then we redid the same analysis, but only restricting to people who have the same HLA, so this presentation mechanism, as Terry. And then we can figure out who had COVID pretty well. So basically, we can. Once we know the sort of the genetic makeup of the person, just by looking at the repertoire, we're able to figure out who had COVID and not. We're not really making money out of this yet because it's very expensive, much more expensive than the antigenic test you get in the pharmacy, but it's possible. Okay, so back to these curves I was showing you about sharing. These are T cells, how many people share a given receptor. The same is true for B cells. However, if you look at people who recently had COVID and you look at the B cells, this is another arm of the immune system that works the same way, essentially, you see that there's outliers. So people who recently had COVID share many more receptors between themselves than predicted by chance. So there's some sort of convergence that COVID imposes. Okay, and so in the last few minutes, I have like 5 minutes? Yeah, okay. So I'd like to turn to a different but related problem of basically, that was response, right? COVID is clearly a strong perturbation of your repertoire, as we saw in this B-cell example. But most of the time, nothing really happens to you, right? You know, you have the sniffles and, you know, everybody's sort of fine. So we asked the question, what happens when nothing happens? And so we took data from people over 2 years who didn't undergo any serious infection over these 2 years, didn't get vaccinated, basically nothing happened to them. And we asked, what are the dynamics of nothingness? And so again, we did the same idea. We had control replicates, which is the blue data, and we had data a year apart, which is the red data. And we basically want to know how different is the red data from the blue data. With the idea now, if we want to identify response, and we'd want to do it seriously, we want to subtract the background. We want to subtract the natural dynamics of the system. So our question is, what is the natural dynamics of the system? Okay, so what happens basically naturally in an unstimulated system, roughly the same thing happens, but at a slower rate. There's a constant influx of new cells from this production process, from this generation process we already described. These cells divide. They don't really proliferate. They divide in a smaller way, and they die. So that's basically it. The concentration, the abundances of given clones are governed by cell division and death. We can rewrite this in log space, and we get a geometric Brownian motion. So now everybody, half of the people in the room should be getting a warm and fuzzy feeling, right? Finally, something you understand. And where we have a characteristic timescale of a decay rate and a characteristic timescale of noise. So are you interested where this came from in detail? Or should I just skip to the punchline? up to me. The punchline will take 2 minutes. Okay, basically, maybe I can do this quickly. So, okay, there is the real process of division, dev, and so on. And of course, it depends somewhat on antigen stimulation, because even if you don't get a serious infection, well, you maybe are trying to fight something off and so on. So, you know, there's some sort of biology that goes into this. This is the full model. But it turns out that what we can say is that what really matters, what a given clone feels, is some mean fitness, so some mean desire to grow or mainly die, because it has to be negative on average, and some fitness fluctuations around this mean. And we can model the environment as basically being some sort of time-correlated antigenic environment. And it turns out that then we can make a separation of timescales approximation of saying that, in fact, the environment autocorrelation time is much slower than other timescales, so we can decorrelate the environment. And if we look at the distribution it gives us, so these are the power laws I was talking about, it doesn't really change anything compared to the full model. And this is a model that we can solve in the Fokker-Planck description if we add this introduction of novelty, and it does give us a power law with an exponent that we can derive exactly. So then we look at the data, and that's what we see. So this is if we just look at the clone size distributions from the data, we see that for all of these people, despite having different ages, being of different genders and, again, backgrounds, they all fall on the same one line with an exponent close to 1. Exponent close to 1 is interesting in itself, as you know, but we can talk about that later. So this is just plotting the data. Now we can do the inference with the noise model, and on top of the noise model, inferring the dynamical model, and we can independently infer the amplitude of the fluctuations and the time scale of the fluctuations and the time scale of the deterministic motion. And we see that, again, they all roughly fall on the same line. So this is the same data, just analyzed differently. This is the theoretical prediction for what the exponent is. And the line here is what? The ratio 1. So you see, well, there is a consistent time scale, it holds. And so now if we look at what this time scale looks like as a function of people's age, it changes significantly with time. So if you're young, you have a time scale of, well, over there about 10 years for the turnover of your repertoire, right? That means this is the time scale for the turnover of your repertoire. So your repertoire renews itself on the time scale of about 10 years. It grows to about 20 years at around 40, presumably. By the time you're 60, it's more like 40 years. So basically, if you're around 40, hopefully, if your life expectancy is that of an average European, you're still going to renew your immune repertoire. If you're 60, well, you're going to be the world record if you do. So there's significant signatures of aging here, so which we can infer from the data. I wanted to say something else, but I forgot. So I'll finish here with probably the most important message of my talk, that, well, don't kill anyone, right? Even if you have an identical twin. And from the last slide, you may be thinking, oh, I'm 20, I'm fine. Unless, you know, if I get away with it for the next 20 years, I'll be fine. Well, still don't kill anyone. You can have pre-existing COVID immunity. You can also get stable post-infection immunity. And as we get older, our turnover slows down. But the most important thing I really think I want to say is that although the system is very stochastic, it's very random, undoubtedly, I mean, with the right kind of probabilistic Bayesian approach, we can still learn the rules, and we can use these stochastic rules to predict stuff. So thank you.